Hi, this is Alan Shartok. Joining me today is Peggy Post. Peggy Post is Emily Post's great-granddaughter-in-law and is a director of the Emily Post Institute and author of more than a dozen etiquette books. Peggy's most recent book is the 18th edition of Emily Post's Etiquette. Peggy writes a monthly column in Good Housekeeping magazine, as well as a biweekly online column in the New York Times called The Well-Mannered Wedding. In addition to Northeast Public Radio, her media appearances include Oprah, Dr. Phil, The View, Live with Regis and Kelly, The Today Show, Good Morning America, Dateline, VH1, and CNN. Peggy conducts lectures and seminars for businesses, trade associations, and community organizations throughout the U.S. Peggy also has a website, emilypost.com. She and her husband live in Southwest Florida. Welcome, Peggy Post.
Well, thank you, Alan.
Now, Peggy, when you go to that dinner party, you know, in Florida, and they're all the dudes and dudesses are, you know, are sort of there.
Right.
Do you ever get the feeling that every one of them are watching you to make sure you don't make a mistake? Because you know they'll be out there on the hustings talking about, I had dinner with Emily Post's successor, and she used the wrong fork.
Well, we're all human, but I really don't worry about that too much. Emily used to say to people, well, I'm not perfect, I'm human. And that's really been my philosophy all along. The funny part, when you mentioned going to a dinner party or a lunch or whatever, when I meet people for the first time, most of them are so nervous about their own table manners that just really freak out, basically. And I keep saying, please, don't worry, etiquette's all about making people feel comfortable. And I'll kind of joke around and say, well, I'm not giving grades. Don't worry, I'm not watching how you hold your fork.
But people do get grades. My wife and I, Roselle, went to Germany, and the tour guide sort of fell in love with my wife. And she's just a great lady of etiquette and all the rest. And a year after we were there, we got this postcard in the mail. Unsigned, saying you're a wonderful lady, da da da, but your husband is a slob. And she said, oh. And he pushed his peas around with his knife on.
Oh, that's crazy.
The plate.
You're right. People do watch each other, but that's pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. And if you've used your utensils to push your peas around, that's perfectly fine.
Well, in Judaism, there is a whole reform group, which I'm one, you know, who do not follow the old rules the same way. Are you a reformed Postian?
Well, we'll go back to the basic philosophy of etiquette, and it's really a code of behavior based on respect and consideration and kindness and honesty. So I'm a traditional etiquette person from that standpoint, but I do keep up with the times, just like Emily did, and we adapt those principles to our world today. So keeping up with being kind to each other is really what it's all about. Yes, people do look at others' manners, whether it's table manners, cell phone manners, or lack thereof, but the underlying principles is being kind to each other.
Okay, is there anything that ticks you off? I'll give you one that ticks me off. My wife likes to take the train to New York City,
right?
And I like to drive. And as soon as I get in the car, there's always some kid who is saying, like, that, like, and it drives me out of my mind. Shut up already. That's one that, you know, there's a sort of, how concerned are you about everybody else who's all around you?
Well, you were right. A lot of people don't like some of those words, like, or hey guys, or whatever. And it's all about creating awareness. I thought you were actually going to go with, when you're driving, what really drives you crazy is somebody texting in the car next to you.
Oh, yeah.
That's dangerous as well.
Yeah.
Yes. But being aware of other people around us, whether we're talking in a loud voice or not holding a door, and that's why we keep talking about these, quote, manners or how we interact with each other.
When you sit down at the table at a fancy thing, if you ever get invited to a fancy thing, what should your first move be? Putting your napkin on your lap or what?
Well, the technical rule is you wait for your host or hostess to put his or her napkin on his or her lap. But I wouldn't worry too much about the old that old rule. Yes, you do put your napkin on your lap. Even before you do that, if you're at a, let's say at a business function or a social function, one of those round tables of 8 to 10 people, and maybe you don't know the other people or the people across the table, that big round table from you, if you have an opportunity, it's a great thing to go over and actually introduce yourself and meet the other people. That's what I try to encourage, and I try to do that myself if you have an opportunity. That's the first thing. So I'll go back to one of Emily's sayings, which I really always love. That is, she used to say, it really doesn't matter so much or as much what fork you use, as what really matters is being interested in the people you're having a meal with. And of course, it's great to know what fork you use. One, you're not worrying about it or thinking about it. You do it seamlessly. And two, there are people who judge you if you use your fork wrong or the wrong whatever. But it's really interacting with the other people. That's the first thing to do, is meet the other people. Then, yes, put the napkin on your lap and go from there.
What if the people next to you are as boring as watching paint dry? Do you have to fake it?
Well, try to really find the most interesting thing you can about that person. Try to draw them out, ask a question, grin and bear it, don't ignore them, that's the key. And then talk to the people on the other side of you, don't just talk to one person. Try to draw other people in, maybe there can be a three-way conversation or the whole table kind of conversation. But if that person's just, you just want to yawn or leave, just try to be as gracious as possible.
You raise a very interesting point. The thing that really ticks my wife and I off is we go and we have dinner with another couple.
Right.
And inevitably, they both have, the other couple may have great needs, and they want to separate you. We like to have, do you know what I'm talking about? We love
I
it.
Do.
We love it when, you know, the conversation remains a four-way conversation, and we always try to bring it back to that, but there are some people who simply won't have it. Got any advice?
You mean somebody just hogging the whole conversation?
No. What happens is the husband and the wife split off, and
right.
they each grab one of you. And inevitably, you got one ear open, and you're hearing something interesting that's going on in the other one. You know, want it to stay among the four of you. You don't want to have...
Right,
So how do you bring it back?
Well, it's an art. You don't want to be looking away from that person. But when there's a lull in the conversation, try to throw something out to everybody, and it's a matter of timing. You don't want to offend the one person you're talking to. Or you could say, let's ask so-and-so and so-and-so what they think about this, and try to make it a group
conversation. That's a great idea. Now, that's a great idea. In other words, Mrs. is talking to you about something on the radio or something, and then the other guy's talking to, and you just simply stop the conversation by saying, let's ask the other guys what they think. I think that's a terrific idea.
Right.
I'm going to try that.
And try a common something. Maybe the other couple's been to Germany like you have. So you can say, let me get my wife to tell you about such and such. Draw the other people in.
Okay, what if you drop a utensil on the ground? What's the deal?
Well, the deal is, let's say you're at a restaurant. You drop a utensil and it goes kind of under the table or whatever. Don't go climbing around looking for it. What you do is, without snapping fingers and making a big issue, wait till the server is nearby and say, could I please have another knife? I dropped mine. Now, if the knife or whatever the utensil is blocking everybody's passageway or someone's going to trip on it, then use your good common sense. And if it's really a danger, then yes, you could kind of get it, but I would recommend just mentioning it to somebody. There's a fork over there that I don't want you to trip on as I come by.
We are talking to Peggy Post, who is Emily Post's great-granddaughter-in-law, director of the Emily Post Institute, and author of more than a dozen etiquette books. The most recent book from Peggy Post is the 18th edition of Emily Post's Etiquette. Okay, so Peggy, you mentioned something that really got my attention just a moment ago, which is snapping fingers to get a waiter's attention.
Right.
Obviously, there are some rules for how you treat your server. And I wondered if you could help us out with what to do and what not to do.
Well, at the top of the list is treat that person with respect. And don't demand. Instead, request or ask and say please. It's the good old basics. And that's a person. Don't just treat them like somebody who's going to run around for you all the time. Say thank you. And ask in a really gracious, polite, courteous manner. And you'll probably get better service as well if you treat that person with respect. But it's not just to be self-serving. It's people are people. And another principle that's timeless is treat the people who serve you with respect. End of story.
Okay, tipping.
Yes.
You know, I'm a 20% tipper. I don't know why I'm a 20% tipper, but from the rudest to the best, I figure they have to make money and it's fair, fair is fair. Give them 20%. Now, there is a whole new breed of people out there. I have one friend who believes that, you know, if somebody doesn't do a great job, give them 12%. I think it's probably my own deficit of character that says, I don't want to mess with people, you know, but
maybe
give them 20%. But there are now people who are saying, give them a lot more than 20%. I wonder if you could help us on tipping.
Tipping is a huge minefield. It confuses people. And there are all kinds of reasons how tipping came into being. One is it's an acronym for to ensure promptness. Way back when the horse and buggy days, the ale houses in England, to ensure that people would be served, the tip ahead of time, just to make sure that things would go smoothly. All these years later, tipping is part of our culture, for sure, in the U.S., and it's really something to say thank you. Simple as that, but a lot of people are, A, confused about it or cynical about it, but in reality, especially in restaurants, the wait staff is taxed on tips, that the average tips along with their wages. So it's part of how they make their money, and it's part of our world. So to your question, it's here to stay, but to your question, how do you tip? Do you do your 20%, which is very, very gracious. I don't think it's that your chicken got it back. 20%, 18 to 20% is the general standard. Some people tip more, and I've been told people who have been waiters, waitresses, often tip more because they know how well-earned a tip is. Mm. If you cut back on your tip because service is really bad, that's okay. I wouldn't stiff the person and give nothing. If the person, it's really the wait person's fault, they were indifferent, they were rude, then that's when you cut back. But don't cut back if service, the restaurant is short-staffed and it's just really slow and your server's really trying to please you and is telling you it will be here in a minute. So use your best judgment. Tipping is here to stay. I'd go with the 18 to 20% standard. Go higher if you really want to, or cut back if you have to.
Are there any real no-nos? I love to know about the wait staff. So if it's a young person, being a professor, I frequently say, where'd you go to school? Or are you studying to be an actor? The rest. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason not to do that?
I think it's very kind. If you want to do that, that's fine. Some people say you're not supposed to talk to the person who serves you. I don't believe that at all. These are people. So I think that makes for a better rapport. It makes it more interesting for you. And it's a kind gesture if you want to talk to somebody serving you. If you don't more than please, thank you, and making your order, that's placing your order, that's fine as well.
Talk to us, as I know you do, in your columns and in your books, about business etiquette. This is a whole area of how, you know, you treat people you're trying to do business with, how you treat the boss. When you're eating around a table, do you shut up and let the person, the mark, do the talking? Tell us a little.
Huge topic. At the Emily Pitt Post Institute, we receive a lot of requests for doing business etiquette seminars, and we have been doing these for years now. And yes, etiquette, getting along with people in business is good business. It's huge, and a lot of businesses, organizations, and associations realize that, and so they do want to refresh, you might say, their employees on how to get along, or teach some of the basics, everything from table manners to how to network, how to greet somebody, shake hands. You mentioned going to Japan, how to get along in other cultures.
Give them a
really
card.
Important. Yeah. Really important topic. So, yes, business etiquette is huge, very important. We have a business etiquette book. I co-authored that with my brother-in-law, Peter Post, And it's really important to be able to get along from, we have a whole chapter on cubicle etiquette and
getting along. Let's stop right there. What's cubicle etiquette?
It's pretty basic. Getting along with your coworkers. For one thing, don't hover over that cubicle top and bother the person next to you. Yeah. If you're going to eat your fried onion rings, try to do that in the kitchen, not in your cubicle, because you can drive everyone crazy with the odors or just noises or tapping or talking in a loud voice. Those are ideas of what cubicle etiquette is all about. It's really getting along with your coworkers in that sense. And being respectful goes throughout the board. When you tell a client or a coworker you're going to call him or her back, then do it, even if you don't have the answer. Mm. Email etiquette is huge. In the work world, it's really important to be professional, even when you send an email or when you tweet or
Stop there for a second, Peggy right. Post. Tell us about the email etiquette. Can you give us some specifics?
Yes, I can. Put something in your subject line. Don't just send a message because you're wasting someone's time. They don't know what it's all about. Respond to your emails, hopefully within 24 hours. If you're going to be out of the office, put out of the office, please contact so-and-so in your outgoing email message. When you send an attachment, make sure that that person gets it. Sometimes people won't want to open an attachment if they aren't sure what it is or who you are. You might embed that content right in your email. Try not to write emails that are just so long. Proofread your email, spell correctly, use a salutation, especially when you're contacting somebody for the first time.
Peggy, do you think if you don't use, one thing I'm sure is part of etiquette is never interrupt somebody when they're saying something, which I just did, and I apologize. But I wondered about this business of emails and whether or not if somebody misspells a word or uses ungrammatical terms, does that reflect badly on them to the point where they might not get a job? Or because I know that I look at stuff that comes into the radio station, people applying for jobs, and we lay them aside if they can't spell.
Well, you answered your question. Yeah. Yes, it is a reflection on that person or on that person's organization. And so it's so important, especially in the job hunting world, to proofread. Resumes now go out by way of email instead of the snail mail way usually. Email it's been evolving now for so long. It used to be back in the previous two editions of etiquette that I wrote, the 16th and 17th editions, we used to say, don't email a thank you note. Well, that's changed, especially when you're job hunting. You may certainly, and I recommend, emailing a thank you note right away after your interview and then follow up with a handwritten thank you note. Both of those are good. Email is just so much quicker. And someone, the person interviewing you might be traveling or so on, but follow up with a handwritten note. Both are important as far as being professional.
Well, how do you reconcile both? I mean, I do all these interviews and somebody emails me or sends a handwritten letter. And being a 70-year-old, I must say, I always appreciate a handwritten note. But how do you do both? If you send the email, it's nice seeing you or interviewing with you.
Right,
then how do you justify a second handwritten letter?
Well, you can never send too many thank yous, especially when you're seeking a job and you often will stand out from the crowd because you are really reaching out. And you just said you appreciate receiving thank you notes. People in their 20s appreciate receiving thank you notes. I hear a lot about thank you notes for wedding gifts, and those are still necessary, handwritten kind. Mm. So you could do a short thank you, back to your question in the email, and then embellish it a little bit more. Mention something about the interview in your handwritten note. And you certainly can be creative and be professional at the same time. And you can be succinct. You don't have to write volumes.
I remember when I was in Japan, part of the etiquette was that everybody got a business card. They gave you a card, you gave them a card, the rest of the stuff. Tell us about business cards. I've seen people with their entire resume on their business card. And I've often said, what is that all about? You know, what do you do?
Well, that's a little overwhelming to have too much on your business card. I recommend still in this day and age having a physical address, not just an email address or a website and a phone number, because some people do want to send something through the postal service. Don't put too much on. Make the business card clean and neat as far as the typeface and so on. And don't have them all turned and dirty. Make sure you have a clean set of business cards.
Guilty.
And in the U.S. and in Japan, wherever you are, the presentation is important. Don't just toss your card over, sort of flip it over to somebody. Give it to them. Hopefully the person receiving it will, as you give it to them, hand it over. They'll look at it, not just stuff it in their pocket. Mm. So business cards are an entree. They're a way of introducing each other. It's, again, a respectful sign if you do glance at it and treat it as something important because it's an extension of that person.
I have just learned something. Because I am guilty of that one, too. I keep finding myself not measuring up here. People handing me business cards all the time, and I shove them in my pocket, and I don't look at them. And so now you've said you've insulted that person by not looking at them.
They probably didn't even realize that because we're such a fast-paced society.
You are a very gracious lady.
It's a good idea. One more thing about business cards, and so many people get eager. They're trying to sell something. I would wait, have a little bit of a conversation with somebody if you have an opportunity, and then may I give you my business card instead of just, here's my card. Try to have a few words if you can.
Well, you know, let me give you my personal problem. I run 25 radio stations, and
and
politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources. We know that getting on the air is a scarce resource for some people, not for you, but for some people it is a scarce resource, and therefore there's always somebody who will stop you wherever you are, no matter who you're talking to. And how do you deal with that without having them hate you for the rest of your life?
Stop you in what way?
So there was a guy, let's just say, on one of the great morning shows in New York, who I saw at a farmer's market. And I walked up to him, and I introduced myself to him and said, I'm Alan Chartok from WAMC. And he said, so? So I didn't like that guy.
That was a real polite thing.
I don't like that guy forever.
Right.
That's all it took. That one thing.
Right.
I want to avoid that. But on the other hand, there's a limit. So tell me what to do when somebody comes crashing in to a conversation you're having and just starts, you know, taking over.
Right, right. Yeah, we've all run into that one. Well, you try to just take a deep breath and slow down, and you might even say something like, we're just talking about such and such, and we want to see you in just a second. Or weave them into your conversation. Try to take control of it. That's very rude to just barge into somebody else's conversation, as is the person who was saying to you, so. That was extremely rude. That didn't make you feel comfortable at all. So it's a give and take. Common sense. And if you see somebody you want to talk to, kind of wait, not kind of, definitely wait before barging into a conversation. People get excited about seeing each other, and there's nothing better than a spontaneous hello, it's great to see you again. But try to get a feel for what's going on before going up to other people in a conversation. Something that it made me think, one of the most frequently asked questions received in the almost 20 years I've been doing this is, how do you introduce people when you can't remember somebody's name?
It happens
to everybody, and you meet a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
So here you are with one of your business associates, and you see someone that you met 5 years ago, but you know you've met that person. You have a couple of choices. If you have a chance, you can ask somebody else ahead of time.
See
that person over across the room? Do you remember his, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But you probably won't have that opportunity. Mm. So instead of ignoring that person, you go up and say, oh, it's nice to see you again. And I often find if you say it's nice to see you instead of nice to meet you, you're allowing the fact that you might have met that person, because it's really awkward when you say, oh, but we already met. So you can say nice to see you when you're being introduced to somebody. But if you can't remember someone's name, you may fess up and say, I've just drawn a blank. I know we've met, but I've drawn a blank on your name, but I'd like for you to meet Joe Jones here or whatever. Or you could mention the person's name, whose name you know, and gesture over to the other person, and that other person will probably offer their name.
I do that, you know, but sometimes I actually say, introduce yourselves.
Right, right. Well, there you go. That's another one. But the bottom line to that is, it's so much more important to introduce people than to ignore people and not to introduce.
No,
so
it's a bad area.
So running into people, there are all kinds of things to do. But
There's the Mario Cuomo way. I don't know if you know it, but somebody would come up to him. I wrote a book about this, and they would say, I bet you don't know me. I met you in the Astoria basement at the so-and-so function 25 years ago. I bet you don't remember my name.
Oh, yes, that puts people on the spot, right?
And he would say, yeah, of course I remember you. You are, ... forcing them to say their own.
Right, right. Exactly.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Peggy Post, of course, is Emily Post's great-granddaughter-in-law, director of the Emily Post Institute. The new book is Emily Post's Etiquette. So, Peggy, how did you get into it? I mean, how did you, of all of them, you mentioned your brother-in-law, Peter, how did you get to sort of take over the empire?
Well, it goes, Emily Post wrote her first etiquette book in 1922, had this career that was amazing. And after her death in 1960, my father-in-law and mother-in-law basically ran the Emily Post Institute. Emily only had one grandchild, and that's my father-in-law. My mother-in-law, Elizabeth Post, who was Emily's granddaughter-in-law, ended up writing books for 20-plus years. And so she became the spokesperson for the Institute. Before she retired, the family asked me if I would like to do this.
Why you? But why you?
Why me? I don't know. No, I'm married to the oldest of four in our generation. There are three sons and a daughter and of the children of my in-laws. And I had taught English and been in the business world. And I was just asked if I'd like to do this someday. And it's quite an honor. And I tried it and loved it. So it's been quite a journey. It's been fascinating. And I get to meet people like you, even if it's just over the airwaves. But it's been really fascinating. What happened was etiquette became a pretty popular word in the 1990s, late 90s. And my brother-in-law, Peter, and I, it's a family business, the Emily Post Institute. Then we wrote this business etiquette book together. And so Peter got involved and it's been expanding. So we're all in this together, basically. My sister-in-law, Cindy Post Senning, and I've written several children's books. And the two nieces and a nephew, the next generation, are now writing books. Anna Post, Lizzie Post, and Daniel Post Senning are co-authors of the 18th edition of Emily Post Etiquette with me. So we've expanded and we are having a great time.
First of all, your childhood.
Yes.
What in your childhood prepared you for etiquette later in life? Did your folks try to train you to be a person who watched what you did and how you did it?
Oh, I was so lucky. My parents were so aware of other people and very kind people and empathetic. So I didn't really grow up with, quote, rules like you must set the table this way. Of course, they taught me how to set the table, but they really focus more on being kind to others. And that's really the most important benchmark right there.
And where was your home?
I was born in Washington, D.C., grew up in Maryland, and then moved to New Orleans.
And, interesting.
And I was just very lucky to be aware of other people and being taught that you don't rank people by money or names or anything else. People are people, and that's what I learned. And that really applies so perfectly to what I've been doing ever since. And I had been a teacher. I love teaching, and that's what all this is about, is teaching people that etiquette is for everybody of all walks of life, all socioeconomic groups. It's not people with money or no money. It's for all kinds of people, and everyone benefits from practicing these principles.
Well, let me ask you something, because I'm fascinated by a little snatch of what you just said. You talked about moving to New Orleans. So you live, do you live in New Orleans now?
No. Lived there, then moved to New York, your state.
Well, this is so interesting. I have a son who lives in New Orleans. And
great.
Yeah, and we visit quite frequently, and we love it. Now, the question is, what is the difference between etiquette in New York, which you just mentioned,
right,
Florida, and New Orleans? Is there a geographic difference in etiquette?
Oh, I love this question. At the very basic core of etiquette, there's no difference. It's really about those principles of respect, consideration, and so on. Of course, cultures are different. So we have different mannerisms. I've done some business etiquette seminars, and I also did a workshop in New Orleans for teens. And yes, there are cultural differences, but at the very core, we're all the same. I've had people in New York ask me, well, aren't New Yorkers ruder than other people? And I said, you're not going to get me to say that. A lot of kind people in New York. And maybe we walk faster when we're in New York, but I just saw someone holding a door for somebody and someone said, thank you. And they went into a big office building. So Yes, we have different cultures, but the core of etiquette is the same.
I held a door for somebody in Albany, New York, in a government building, a woman.
Right.
She walked in and said, you know, you're a pig. You know,
no, she didn't really
say
that.
She certainly did. And
the male chauvinist thing. Well, then she was not at all polite.
She was rude. But in the South, quite frequently, you'll hear sir and ma'am.
Yes.
And you won't hear that in New York City.
Right. That's cultural. And I know I've had friends in New York say, why do the people say that down there? I said, that's part of the culture. And that a lot of children are still taught to say sir and ma'am. And that's a regional thing.
Huh. So your folks taught you to be kind, and you've moved around, and you've observed some of the cultural differences. Are there any of them in any of the places you've been that offend you? I mean, we're talking just you and me, nobody else listening. But
not at all.
Yeah.
if they are part of culture, if it's something that culture deems okay, then even if it's different from what I am used to, I will accept it. That's their culture. It makes me think of a talk I gave when I was on my first book tour, and there were some children in the audience, and this one little boy raised his hand during the question and answer part, and he says, he was kind of giggling, and he was about 11, 12 years old. Mm. He goes, well, I hear it's okay to burp after eating, and I think he said Germany. And he said, so what about that? Because my parents won't let me do that. And I said, well, if that's part of that culture, then that's okay. And so, answer to your question, I really don't get offended by other cultures. I'm fascinated by traveling and learning about other cultures.
But of course, things have changed in the United States. So,
of course.
So, you know, 50 years ago, there were whites and non-white bathrooms,
right,
and things of
right.
that kind. So surely one has, you know, can be offended by the cultural norm of a time like that, and especially since your parents trained you to be respectful, you know, to
right,
all people.
Right.
We're about to see the new Jackie Robinson film,
in which, right? Yes.
You know, in which he was, he was ostracized, and they used their cleats on him and the rest of it. So surely some of our basic politics comes into play when we're talking about ethics.
Oh, absolutely.
There was a question there somewhere.
Well, you know, it made me think. The Pew Institute does a lot of
Indeed.
Different studies yeah. and surveys, and done some work with them. And Americans, we're more inclusive than we used to be. We certainly have a long way to go. But I think each generation is getting more and more inclusive in so many ways. And that's a good thing.
So when we talk about gay marriage, for example,
right,
that would fit into what you're saying about inclusivity.
Absolutely. And I've written about gay weddings called Civil Unions back in my first wedding etiquette book in 1999. And that's our world. In fact, one of my first national interviews on a national TV station, I was asked by a reporter, so what do you do if you're invited to a gay wedding? And I said, well, you do the same thing you do when you're invited to any wedding. You make sure you RSVP. You're probably happy for the couple because you know them and you've been invited. So if you can go, that's great. Be sure to send a gift and so on. So people, we're all the same in so many ways. And that's really what I'm talking about as far as being inclusive.
But there are some things you have to learn. For example,
Absolutely.
I've been reading the New York Times wedding announcements, and he said something to his husband.
Right.
Are both partners husbands? I mean, that's the kind of thing where you make a mistake. You don't want to make a mistake. You don't
right.
want to offend
well,
anybody.
Well, that's a whole evolution as far as new manners, and that's why we keep updating the books. And you may say husband, you may say partner, you may ask that couple, how do you like to be referred to? What do you call each other? So it can be awkward with new manners, and it makes me also think about when people write condolence notes, they say it's so awkward to do. I say, well, just write it anyway, write from the heart. There's no set form for a lot of this, but reach out to the person. So back to your question about husband or partner, you may ask that person if you know him or her well enough, or just say hello. You don't have to say hello, husband.
What happens when, no matter your best efforts, you offend somebody? And there are those people in society,
sure.
yes, who will take, they're professionals at taking offense,
right.
and they will.
Right. So,
Is there another stage? I mean, what do you do then?
Well, some people like to point out other people's flaws and faux pas and say, that was really rude. If you're the person that puts your foot in your mouth, the best thing you can do is say, I'm so sorry. Like, start with that and be sincere about it.
Yeah.
In my Good Housekeeping column, I have sometimes I have little snippets. What do you do if you say, when are you expecting your baby? And the woman says, oh, I had my baby 3 months ago. I mean, we all say things that we wish we hadn't. Try to think before speaking. But if we do say something offensive, apologize and be sincere about it.
Huh. Well, I do a lot of that. When you are answering questions,
right,
and you get questions and you have to answer them during that time, do you ever think you're being set up? In other words, somebody asks a question and it's complicated, and then, you know, you answer it, and then they come back at you. You know, how do you handle that as a professional?
Occasionally people will do that, or they'll have their own real sticky situation. And really, etiquette is about relationships. So, yes, I do get some questions. Someone will try to come up with a trick question. I love question and answer, so that's why I'm enjoying your questions so much. If someone's trying to set me up, if you will, I can't take it personally. I give them my honest answer. A lot of times when I'm asked an etiquette question, it's really sticky.
Yeah.
And it might be, I'll give an example. Someone's getting married,
yep,
and their parents are divorced,
yep,
and the other woman is now married to the father. I'm putting other woman in quotes. And the mother of the, say, bride is saying, well, I'm not coming to the wedding if she's going to be
nice
there. So what's the right answer here? And I'm saying, well, the right answer is, first of all, there's no perfect answer. And someone will want me to take sides, and I can't. I'll say, these are your options. You have to apply them to your situation and come up with what's going to make the most people feel comfortable. And as far as the parents in that situation of the wedding, put your hatchets aside and think about the couple getting married and try to get along. You don't have to sit next to each other. You don't have to be right next to each other. But think about the big picture here. That's the couple getting married. So a lot of times if someone's trying to set me up and take sides, for example, I just won't do it. I'll say, these are your options. You can fall back in tradition and do such and such, but you have to figure it out.
I have a friend, a very good friend, who got married. I never got along with his wife, and he got divorced. He was paying for the wedding of the daughter, and I was told that the wife had issued an ultimatum that my friend could either have me at the wedding and my wife, or his brother, you know, at the wedding. This guy was footing the whole bill. So, you know, what do you do in a situation like that? You know, you're being told what the choice is.
That's interesting. Well, people do that all the time with weddings. I don't understand why you were the brother. It's probably a headcount issue there. I'm not sure.
Oh, I think it was probably an anger issue.
But anger issue, because it maybe didn't like the brother.
Or me.
Either.
That's correct.
I don't know.
That's right. That's exactly
so
right. You got it
I'd
right.
I'd say your friend needs to stand up very calmly and say, I really would like to have both of them there. They mean a lot to me.
Yeah, well,
and take it from there.
I think that's exactly what happened.
Right.
But very nice. Do you ever consult with experts? In other words, when you get asked etiquette questions, do you ever, you know, go to a psychologist or a sociologist or, you know, a psychiatrist because the question supersedes, you know, what you think you know about a subject?
Right, right. Well, I don't give a tax advice and I don't give heavy-duty psychological advice.
Right, right.
But I have met a lot of people along the way that are experts in their fields, and I'll certainly ask them questions. Sometimes I've spoken with a wedding consultant group, and there's a huge professional group called ABC, Association of Bridal Consultants, and I've done a keynote address a couple of times with them, and they'll have thousands of wedding professionals. And so I've gotten to know some wedding professionals, and I'll ask them some questions about certain issues and what's going on in the wedding world. So that's an expert who's right there all the time with brides and grooms. So yes, along the way, when I meet somebody who's an expert in their field, it's always really great to talk to them. Someone running a restaurant, I'll ask them about what's going on with tipping these days. So yes, I'm sure you do the same.
I do, but I am much more of a bull in a china shop than you are.
I'm not so sure.
Oh, mixed marriages.
Yes.
That's a tough one, right? I mean, you get a Jewish couple and a Catholic couple, and the parents are putting immense pressure on both sides. Some rabbis won't marry anybody who, it's a mixed marriage. Take us into that forest, if you will.
Oh, the big C, communication, and plan ahead. And interfaith marriages have been around for years. I think it's so important to try to find that happy balance. I did an NPR interview in Washington, D.C. on the Diane Rehm show years ago, and she was out, and substituting for her was Steve Roberts, Cokie Roberts' husband.
Oh, yeah.
And they had just written a book about intermarriage, interfaith marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous approach. And they won over both sets of grandparents and parents. And in their case, they would celebrate both religions, and they raised their children to be familiar with both religions. That's the ideal scenario. Just keep talking it through. Trying to find what's going to work for your situation is really the best possible thing you can do, and try to find a way to get married. If you can bring in the two faiths, great. If not, then find a way to make it work.
Are there etiquette norms that are different in each religion? In other words, do Jewish people and Catholic people have, what you would call etiquette, Emily Post etiquette? Is there a difference in the way in which different religions practice etiquette?
There's some people who say etiquette is really based on the world's religions about really? Being respectful and loving and all those wonderful things. Yes, the religions have, it's like different customs in different parts of the country or the world. The different religions have different rituals for getting married. So, yes, they're different. Rituals is the right word, that come forth in the ceremonies. And it's great to merge these different rituals. And sometimes we'll see weddings that are merging different cultures. Mm-hmm. Maybe I've heard of a Scottish Presbyterian component of the wedding, and the bride was marrying a fellow who is Muslim, and so they merge those two religions and customs as well. So yes, there are differences in the wedding ceremony for sure, and if they can be merged together, that's the ideal.
A wedding's becoming too important. I mean, I tell my kids, we were married on Fire Island in the backyard. We gave people fried chicken and Nova Scotia on bagels and some champagne. That was it.
Right.
200 people, whole wedding cost $500. Now we see 3-day affairs, 4-day affairs, We went to Yugoslavia for my twin brother's daughter's wedding and in a great castle and Tito's, summer home. This can break a family.
Sure can.
This demand, for money.
Oh, you get me started on this one.
Good.
It would be hard to stop me, because I agree 100% with, I think, your drift. I always say some of the most beautiful weddings are some of the simplest, and you do not have to break the bank to have a wedding. And I agree with you. You can have a wedding in the little town place of worship and go to the park for your reception. Or a simple wedding is good. Cut back on the guest list. They don't have to be Cinderella weddings. Our society really has been promoting these Cinderella and celebrity weddings for years. The recession in 2008, that started then, has helped temper some weddings. But weddings are just a huge part of our culture. And there are ways to have weddings without spending a lot of money. There are ways of having weddings that don't have to be overseas in Yugoslavia. Destination weddings have become very popular.
So. Well, I have to be fair about that one. My niece was marrying a Yugoslav.
Go. And it's great. Weddings can be destination weddings. They can be huge, glamorous affairs. But my key point is, be realistic. I'm saying that to couples. You don't have to go into debt for years just to have a wedding or a 3-day wedding. You could have a really special, wonderful wedding, but think it through and be smart about it. And it can be just fabulous, beautiful, everything you always wanted, but plan well, and you don't have to go overboard.
What about the parents? I mean, what is their obligation? In the old days, the bride's father paid for the wedding. Now kids are getting married much later.
Well,
sometimes they're making more money than their parents are. So what do you do?
Well, first of all, the traditional list of who pays what or paid what back in those days. And some weddings are go that way. The bride's parents pay for the bulk of it. The groom's parents pay for the traditional expenses. But these days, couples are getting married later in life. A lot of times the bride and the groom make a lot more money than their parents.
Yep.
A lot of couples are paying for the entire wedding themselves. Or it's a big mixture of the bride's parents, the groom's parents, and the couple paying for different parts. The key etiquette principle there is don't demand, I need you to give us this much money. We ask parents, have good fluid conversation and saying, would you be able to help out and what could you do? And this is what we're thinking. Have those conversations before making all the plans, work on the budget. And bottom line answer to your question, weddings are expensive these days. So couples and their families are figuring out a way to share the expenses.
So we do have this sort of this industry, this wedding industry, right?
Yes, definitely.
And it's like in the Christmas cards or the, you know, the cards that these industries that they, you know, you're really outside the pale if you don't do what you're supposed to do. Yeah. But I have seen parents literally get very close to the poorhouse because they're so ashamed of not being able to do what's demanded by these this industry.
Right. And I receive questions associated to that New York Times column you mentioned that are fascinating. And they'll be from the bride or the groom, and they'll say, my father wants to invite 500 of his closest business associates, and we don't want that. And I'll say, well, talk to your father and tell him your dream wedding is 120 people. Maybe if your father wants to have a reception afterwards and have you meet his business associates, fine. But talk it through really carefully. Come up with a compromise. Listen with an open mind. And yes, some parents will, just what you said, want to do this huge wedding. That's fine if the bride and groom want that, or if they agree to it, or if the parents can afford it. There's so many factors. So it really, a lot of it's common sense. As I say, you don't have to break the bank to have a beautiful wedding.
I know. By the way, I think I should mention what you just mentioned. You have a column, online column, in the New York Times called The Well-Mannered Wedding by Peggy Post. And I wanted to say that, as well as the fact that your newest book is the 18th edition of Emily Post's Etiquette. So with that said, I wanted to ask you about weddings in which the young people figure out how many people are coming. Now, I know a couple who decided there should be 200 people at their wedding.
Right.
And they sent out more than 200 save-the-date cards half a year in advance. It was in New Orleans, I'll be honest with you. And everybody wants to go.
Everybody wants to go. Sure.
So now what do you do? Because they hired a place that only holds 200 people.
That's a problem. Try to change the place.
Yeah, try to change the place.
Really.
$2,000 deposit. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, right. No, when save the date notices are great because they do let people start making plans. However, when you send out those save the date cards, you really do need to send an invitation to everybody. And then I've been asked, well, what happens if we're told that Aunt Sue and Uncle Tom cannot attend? Do I still need to send an invitation to them, or some friend cannot attend? I say most cases, yes. And if the bride or groom says, well, it looks like then we're fishing for a gift because then we're sending an invitation. And so use judgment there. Some people change their minds. They can attend after all. If they tell you 6 months ahead of time, they don't think they can. It can hurt feelings, Aunt Sue and Uncle Tom, because then they feel like you don't care about them and you don't send an invitation. But back to your question, 200 people, the place can hold 200 people and more save the dates have been sent, that's a problem because you really do need to include those other people.
Yep, that's right.
And hope that enough people cannot attend and then you're down to your 200. Sometimes it's a numbers game and what percentage will not show up, but it doesn't always work that way. So count on the high number accepting.
Well, Peggy Post, you just mentioned the keyword gifts. What's the latest rule on gifts?
Oh, I think we could have a huge book just on gifts. The guidelines for gifts, are you talking about weddings or in general?
Weddings.
Weddings. The guideline is, and it's still in our culture today, if you receive a wedding invitation, you really hate to use the word obligated, but the custom is you do send a gift, even if you cannot attend that wedding.
Sure.
Now, there are exceptions to every rule, and again, I keep saying common sense. Let's say you receive a wedding invitation from your business associate of 20 years ago's daughter, and the family moved out to California from New York 20 years ago, you've pretty much lost touch with them, but you receive a wedding invitation to the daughter's wedding. Well, in that case, I would make sure you RSVP no matter what. You could send a congratulatory note or card, maybe a small gift, but you don't always have to send a gift if you've just totally lost track of that person.
What about money versus gift?
That's totally okay.
But I'm trying to figure out what you do. If you're thoughtful about the gift, you don't have to spend the same amount of money as if you hand somebody a check.
Yes.
And Is that too manipulative? No,
you're using common sense there. But no, real quickly about the money as gifts. In a lot of cultures, money has always been the gift. And now in the last 15 or so years in the U.S., money has become acceptable, is probably the right word, across the board as a gift. But the gift, it's really the gift giver's prerogative as to what to give. And if that person wants to give money, great. If that person wants to give a tangible item, that's also great. They don't have to select a gift off the registry, the gift registry. They may surprise the couple. Back to your point, sometimes you get, I guess, really say more bang for your buck if you buy something versus handing over a check. So base your selection of a gift on your affection for that bride and groom or their families, how well you know them, somewhat what's customary in your circle of friends or whatever, and on your budget, and then give them a gift, whether it's cash or the other. Both are okay. And also what you think the couple would like is important.
And on the registry thing, we registered. It was against my nature to register, but we did it. Yeah, go ahead.
It's helpful to your guests. It's against your nature. It's okay because you're helping them. They don't have to use it.
I came from more of the, you know, hippie side. So therefore, it was, I rejected, you know, the conventional, but we did it because, it was expected of us. And we still have the plates.
Well, good. Well, you need plates. And yes, okay, there are some material things, and maybe that didn't set well with you at the time, but it's a practical thing, and it does help guests.
Well, I have to say, Peggy Post, we love you for this wonderful interview and this gift of time that you have given us. Peggy Post.
Alan.
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I interrupted you now. Thank you so much. This has been really fun, and your questions have been really engaging and enjoyable. Thank you.
You're terrific. And thanks so much for joining us, all of you. We're out of time. Our guest has been Peggy Post, director of the Emily Post Institute and author of more than a dozen etiquette books, including her most recent book, the 18th edition of Emily Post Etiquette. Peggy, again, thanks for joining us. What a great gift you've given all of us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.
Thank you.